Hello everybody, James here, story time with Dutch Mantel, episode 66.5, or Ask Dutch Anything 10. And
I was doing 66.5, that's what I was doing.
Oh, right, okay then, I just thought you were trying to do 10.
No, I wasn't doing that.
I was struggling with that one then. We won't do the plugs or anything. We've got books, we've got t-shirts, we've got all the stuff that you need. Shane Douglas franchise. Shane Douglas has a podcast with me every Tuesday. You can find that on Shane Douglas Official on YouTube. It should be on audio podcast soon as well, but I'm having iTunes problems and everything like that, but we will leave that there. This episode is all about you, your questions, and if you want to send in your questions for Dutch Mantel to answer, you want to go to questionsfordutch@gmail.com. And if they are good, and if we have the time, then the Dutchman himself will try and answer them for you. And for God's sake, I've just mentioned this to Dutch before, and we're getting more questions, far more questions than we can ever actually answer. We're getting dozens and dozens every single week. So if yours doesn't get answered for whatever reason, then just email it back in a month or two, and it'll get back into the cycle of questions. But right now,
This is what I'm interested in knowing. Mm. I want all the fans who want to write in, I want you to write James and me and tell me how many wrestling podcasts you listen to in a week. Hmm. Don't you think that'd be some valuable information?
I'd be interested in that. I know a lot of people listen to this and the Cornette Show. I know there's a crossover there. Mm-hmm. Quite a big one, because people keep sending in that and saying that there's a crossover. But I don't know what the other crossovers are, quite frankly.
No, we'll find out.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll do a YouTube post today or tomorrow, and I'll say, hello, just a bit of a survey, what podcast do you listen to and why?
Right.
Okay, I'll do that.
Do that? Okay.
For now, though, questionsfordutch@gmail.com, and all the people whose questions I will be putting towards Dutch have just done that. And the first one, Gino Cuddy, but also Perry Horton, asked almost the exact same question, amazingly, this week, but I'm going to read Gino Cuddy's version. He says, I am a longtime fan of the classic era of professional wrestling, especially of the smaller companies and promotions, and would like Mr. Mantel's insights and memories of working in Ron Fuller's Continental Championship Wrestling territory out of Knoxville, Tennessee, his favourite feuds, and working with the late, great Gordon Solie. Now, there's two parts of a question here, but I'll leave it there. So, Continental and Gordon Solie.
Ron Fuller, who we've had on this show before, he was one of the pioneers of the new territories, because he opened up two territories that ended up doing fantastic business. And all he did was he knew what the people wanted. He didn't have any half baby faces and half heels. He had good announcers and good TV. It was an hour show. So he didn't, you know, the shows now are 2 hours. An hour show, I don't know if you could book an hour show. Now you can, but it's a little bit difficult. But I think he opened up Southeastern. Oh, it's Continental. Continental was down south around Pensacola. Mm-hmm. And they used to have a territory down there, but they did business. But Ron got in there, made himself a big heel, the Tennessee Stud, and they just drew fantastic money. And what Ron did, he had territories that guys actually wanted to come to, because the trips weren't long. You know, you'd be back almost every night by 12 o'clock. So a lot of times in Memphis, you'd get back at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2:30 in the morning. Oklahoma, you might not get back into 5 o'clock in the morning. But he had short trips, which appealed to the guys. And he didn't, he would go to a spot show. It had 2,000 people in it because the show was good. Now he did the Southeastern, I think, and that was down south. Then he went to Knoxville, and they had an old time promoter there. He bought him out. I forgot what that old-time promoter's name was. And he opened it up, and he would just rent. Knoxville was his biggest town. And he would run the other towns around Knoxville with the same formula that he ran Pensacola. Short trips, and it drew like a son of a bitch. He very, very intelligent booker, because he knew what the people wanted, and he knew how to get heat on them and get his bait. And he kept a small crew. He probably didn't book more than, say, 14 to 16 guys, and he took care of all of them. See, the thing you worry about is when you run a smaller territory, you're not going to be able to actually turn a profit. And since the name in front of wrestling is pro, you want to make money so you can continue to move along. Ron, and I had a great time working in both of them. Ron was a great booker. You could go in. He's not like a boss. You go in, you say, "Ron, you damn son of a bitch, what the hell?" And he didn't care, because he wanted to be one of the boys. And when he would give you a finish, he'd call you over. "Now you do this." And then all of a sudden, you know, he got this from his daddy, Buddy Fuller, and how to give you a finish. And a lot of times I was going to get beat, and he'd get me so excited, I couldn't wait to get out there to get beat, because I was excited by the way he gave me the finish. But the question is, I really enjoyed working with Ron. And if he opened up another one, if I could, I'd go and work with him again.
Further on that question was, he asks your memories of Gordon Solie.
Well, Gordon Solie. Gordon Solie, he would, by this time, I only ran across him in Southeastern. And Gordon had a issue with drinking. And sometimes he would be okay. Sometimes he'd be a little under the weather, so to speak. And Gordon was never known for his friendliness. I mean, he was friendly, but he wasn't overly friendly. But he was a good announcer. People that followed him in championship wrestling from Florida knew how good he was. And when you heard that name, and you heard him later on from the 605 TBS show, he did that. His voice kind of sticks with you. But a lot of people think that Gordon is the number one announcer in professional wrestling business. He was good, but I wouldn't put him at number one. You know who I'd put at number one?
Do you want me to guess? I think I might know.
Yes, guess.
Lance.
Lance Russell was the number one, to me, wrestling announcer in the old school days. He made it, and he didn't force everything. It was just natural conversation, like we're talking here, and you could listen to him, and he's not beating you up like you have on WWE Raw now. You got those three guys. I mean, it's just constant words. Let it breathe a little bit. I've said this before, but Lance would let it breathe, and I enjoyed listening to him.
With Gordon, I've been muting myself, coughing all the way through your diatribe there. So I actually do like Gordon's a lot, because he has that sort of natural authority. Because, I mean, you can either get that natural authority, authoritative voice, either naturally or by smoking a lot. And I think, I don't know if he had one or the other, but he had a great voice for it. Something else I want to bring up with Gordon that we've never mentioned before is, how many territories was Solie working at one time? Because he seemed to be in Florida, he seemed to be in Continental, he was doing stuff at WCW at times, he seemed to be everywhere at one point.
Well, he made his name in Florida, the Tampa office, and then he went to Atlanta, I think, for a while. And announcers are just like wrestlers. You get gig work. And then he went to Knoxville, and then he went to Continental. I think he worked about four. I don't know if he worked them all at the same time. I don't think he could work them all at the same time.
He did two at the same time, at the very least. He may have done three at the same time at one point. I don't know. He never did Houston, did he?
No.
No.
Never did. He never did Mid-Atlantic either, I don't think. He never did that.
He did WCW after Turner had bought it. I think that's true. So he probably went in just after the purchase.
He did that. But he was a good announcer. Very, very good.
Now, the next half of the question, I wanted to save this because I think I've seen video of this. The promotion being Ron Fuller's Continental, is remembered for its edgy storylines, including the memorable I'd Like to Talk to Tom angle involving Dirty White Boy, Tony Anthony, and Dr. Tom Pritchard. Was Mr. Mantel responsible for any of the booking in the territory, and what was his opinion of working there overall? But we've already talked about that. But do you remember the I Want to Talk to Tom angle? Because that was pretty edgy stuff at the time.
That was good. Because Dirty White Boy had a valet who later on became his wife. She was called Dirty White Girl. And then they kind of, quite naturally, they turned an attraction with Tom noticing her. And you could see it coming that, you know, she was looking at him and he was looking at her. And they told a brilliant story about it. And then Dirty White Boy, he got a lot of heat off that because he would berate her on TV because she had eyes for Tom. And then Tom would go in the defender. So it was one of those things that even though Dirty White Boy treated her like dirt, hence the name Dirty, and Tom was taking up for her, yet she wouldn't leave Dirty White Boy. So now, and this went on a couple months. And the people, and that's what I like about angles. You can read your own feelings into it. Like you can get mad at her for not leaving Dirty White Boy. And Tom is trying to defend her. And you're saying she needs to just go and be with Tom.
Is this the one where she turns up with bruises on her face? And then it's the domestic violence thing or domestic violence thing.
Yeah. That is. But she wouldn't say it was him. And everybody knew it was. That wasn't Ron booking, that was his brother Robert. Mm-hmm. And they told a great story about it. And they drew some decent money with that. I mean, we're not the type, we're selling out every night. But Knoxville was the best town. We'd go in Knoxville and it seats probably 7,000. And I've seen it just jammed completely out. And the average house in there would be about 5,000. But it was a good wrestling town. Some towns are good wrestling towns, and some towns aren't. So if you can take a good wrestling town, when you go in there, say the first time, and it draws a pretty decent house, you can say, well, we may be able to kind of work on this town and get it up. And Ron had a lot of great ideas. This was like in the 70s and 80s. But you think back on it now, you say, God, that was a long time ago. But a lot of ways that it was brand new for the fans. They've never seen stories like this because it used to be just one guy beating another guy up and they going for championship. This had stories behind it. So it made the characters bigger than life. But Ron Fuller and Robert, both good bookers.
Next question, name withheld by request. What's the difference between Tony Khan and Dixie Carter? Honestly, is there really any difference in how they bought into and run/ran their respective wrestling companies?
Well, I read this question before, and what's the difference between Tony Khan and Dixie Carter? First off is the anatomy. That's a difference. But the overriding question is about $3 billion. That's the difference between them. Dixie bought into TNA. And originally she wasn't in it. They had some other investors. And this investor he was the head of an insurance firm in Alabama. And it was only, they got started. I forgot when they started. But the guy who was invested the money from the insurance company, that's what he did. They all of a sudden, he came under federal indictment for fraud and embezzlement. So that threw that damn investment completely up in the air. And then now Jeff and his father, Jerry, now they're looking for an investor. And this is not cheap. You're talking $1 million back then. And it was just a regional company. And Jeff knew Dixie somehow. And he talked to her about, would she be interested? And she thought a minute. She said, no, but my father might. And her father ran a big oil rigging company in Texas.
Panda Energy.
Panda Energy, that's what he ran. And Dixie was in, she was in Nashville trying to run a booking agency for some stars there. She
like,
wanted to
like
do
a
that.
PR firm or something, wasn't it?
Something like that. And so when Jeff went in to talk to her one morning and she's listening to it, she says, be ready at the airport in the morning at 8 o'clock and we'll fly down and we'll meet with my dad on a private plane. I mean, this guy had money, big time money. So they met over there. Jerry met and Jeff met and they got on the plane with Dixie. And they went down there and they closed the deal in one day. And, you know, the old man Carter, what was his first? What was his name? Bob Carter, I think. They closed it. And then that's how Dixie Carter entered the wrestling business. She knew absolutely nothing about it. And she was. She would be influenced by some of the talent because she was a good looking woman and they would see her around and they'd go and the talent would, they'd go and talk to her and she would get to liking them. And then they would get on like a first name basis where the guy could take his problems to Dixie and he could take a problem like, well, they're not really using me that well. And I got this idea. And they'd tell it to her, of course, oh, that's great. That's beautiful. Then she would come and kind of present that idea that we had already rejected. But now you got a deal with her. And then we'd have to do something with the guy. But she got involved in ways that she shouldn't have got involved in. And but that was just something we had to deal with. I was on creative. Vince Russo was on creative. Jeff was on creative. And when we booked the shows, we would go out and to Jeff's house. That's a whole story all unto itself. And
there was a story. Sorry for butting in. How big was Jerry Jarrett's dining table?
How big was it?
Yeah, there's a story that he had like the biggest dining table in Henderson, Tennessee or something like that. I don't know.
I never saw his dining table.
Oh, okay.
Because by the time I got, they were still in Hendersonville. And I never, I used to go over to Jerry's house, but years before this. So, and I'm getting to the point with Dixie that they had a lot of friction within the company. And it was between Vince and Dixie and Jeff, again, I'm going to fall back on my line. I tried to stay in my own lane because whatever differences they had, I wanted to stay away from that. So, but the difference between them, Tony might understand a little bit more about the business now than Dixie ever did. Dixie was never a big fan. She would watch it. But she was never a big fan. And so Dixie wouldn't, sometimes she wouldn't take control like Tony won't take control. But when she did take control, she would called everybody together. I remember one time she called the whole crew together and said, if they didn't like it, they can walk out today. So I said, well, and there was a couple of guys just got up and left, not directly from the meeting. They went to see her and said they wanted to be released. And she said, okay, go. And we didn't hold anybody there that didn't want to be there. And Dixie was a mark for people like Huck and Bischoff, because he was with Huck, and Kurt Angle, and guys like that. Booker T was another one. If they were on WWE, they were much bigger stars than what TNA could ever produce, because they did a good job in getting their talent over. But again, you ran into, if they didn't bring their concerns directly to creative, they would go through Dixie. Then we would hear from it through Dixie, and which is a hard row to hoe. It's not a good way to do business.
So, having said that, with Tony Khan then, so I mean, the very basic story is his dad was very rich and gave Tony a load of money.
Still is very rich.
And basically gave his son a load of money and just said, go have fun, do whatever you want. So he starts a wrestling company. And as far as running a wrestling company day to day, I know you've only met Tony once at a WWE show and you spoke to him once or twice here or there. But as far as you can tell, what are the differences between he and Dixie as far as how to run things? And how easy do you think it is for other wrestlers to manipulate Tony like they did with Dixie?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been around Tony that much. But I think it would probably be fairly easy, because Tony is the type, he doesn't want dissension. He doesn't want chaos. And that's exactly what he's ended up with, because he didn't take control of his own company. Dixie, on the other hand, she didn't want it either. But What Dixie would do, she every time we would do TV, there was a bar at the hotel where we would stay every time we went down there. Embassy Suites, I think, somewhere. I think it was that. No, I'll think about it in a minute. But again, that was where we used to tell her the inmates cannot run the asylum. So we tried to tell her, listen, if they want to talk to us, let them come to us, not going through you. And then you coming to us, because then we feel like we're being watched. That, you know, since you brought it up, that it's like almost a ghost signal, get behind this guy. But it's, and what was the question about Tony and Dixie? What was the question?
Is there any real difference between the two? Just as you were speaking then, I wanted to bring up that both seem like they want to be friends with the talent. And
they
that
do.
Could be a fatal mistake.
Oh, they do. They do. And similar. Because, see, Tony didn't want to just be friends with him. He wants to be a booker. You know, didn't he get Booker of the Year with Meltzer that year?
Yeah, I think so. Three times or something in a row, yeah.
And he wants to be a booker, which is good, which is fine. But he better think about, I think they're making their money off TV, basically, because I don't think they could run enough shows to cover the cost of it. How much money did Tony Khan put in initially, his family?
I don't know. I mean, do you know what? It's probably $100 million.
That's quite a sum of money, mm-hmm. $100 million.
Supposedly, he invested $20 million or so dollars just to bring out the game. It's on all platforms, but you know, the computer game that came out earlier this year. And they had a substantial investment in that I don't know if they've recouped their losses or not on that one. But he's probably invested about $100 million, you know, with all the infrastructure and websites and talent and staff and Mega Parekh hanging about backstage and stuff.
Well, see, Dixie never did any of that stuff. Tony is so stretched, so thin, He tries to do everything. That's where you got to have people in head of certain divisions so they can handle it. And then if they run into a problem, then they can bring it to your attention. Mm-hmm. I think Tony wants to handle everything. And I don't think there's enough hours in the day to do that. So if you want to bring a lot of stress onto yourself, try that for about a year. And Tony's been going 4 years. So, and I said on the podcast this week that I think he's getting a little bit bored with it and tired, and he may want to hand it over to somebody and see what they can do with it.
One more thing I just want to add very quickly, because I'd written this over a month ago because I finally got the name. Do you remember in the very early days of TNA, somebody was feeding the Jarretts information that, wow, 80,000 people bought our weekly pay-per-views and so on and so forth?
I can't remember the guy's name.
I've written it.
What is it?
Jay Hassman.
Yep, that's him.
Yep, he was the guy apparently who was feeding this false information about pay-per-view purchases to the Jarretts, and then they started overspending, and then they find out that they're making, I don't know, only a tenth of what they thought they were, and then it all falls apart, well, and then Dixie comes in.
After the first pay-per-view, that's when he hits them with the news. We did 80,000 buys, and I'm thinking, damn, it was like $35 or $40 per buy.
These were the cheapo ones. These were the $9.95 or $9.99 ones.
Okay.
We were doing the weekly pay-per-views, yeah.
Well, that'd be 800,000, wouldn't it?
Split that in half because...
For the pay-per-view companies.
Yeah. Hey, but 400 grand a week coming in.
That was good. Mm-hmm. But it's only good if it's true. Then the guy came in and told them, guys, I made a mistake, or somebody found out that that was not the accurate number. The accurate number was like 8,000 or 9,000 buys, which, figure that up, that's like 80,000.
Mm-hmm. Split in half.
And the bills were coming due. But before they found out that it wasn't true, I think they went out and they bought a lot of cameras and I don't know if they bought a truck but they bought a lot of stuff to help, you know, that they're going to need later on. And then they found out after they bought it that that's not the correct number. And they don't know what he was doing or how he got the wrong number. Of course, in the days of the conspiracy theories, they figured that Vince paid him to give the fake number so that they would feel real happy about themselves. And that's when Jeff and Jerry both were concerned about the future of the company. And that's why Jeff went to see Dixie personally and sat down at her office in Nashville and told her the problem. And she says, well, meet me in the morning and we will fly to Dallas and we will meet with my father and see what he thinks. And they did. They come up with a deal. He come back, so we continued to run.
Let's move on then. Trent in North Carolina asks, which wrestlers during the 70s and 80s territory days were the safest to travel with, no risk of getting drunk, into legal trouble from town to town, etc.? And also the opposite, who would you not want to travel with for fear of your own safety or getting into trouble because of their wild behavior?
Well, I think a guy that's not going to speed and not going to drink and not getting in trouble would be Barry Horowitz, because he didn't drink, he didn't smoke dope, didn't take pills, and he was a good steady driver. They had another guy that I used to ride with. I can't remember his first name. His last name was, I think his first name was Gordon. I can't remember, but I used to ride with him a lot. The person I didn't want to ride with was several. Jerry Lawler was one of them. He didn't drink though, but he would go 105, 110 miles an hour. He had a new car. He was making money in Memphis because they were settling it out during the summer about 77. He was making big time money. And he had the Cadillac, the big car, is because he did commercials for a Cadillac dealer. And the guy just gave him a car, said, drive this. He drove the living shit out of that car. And when he'd get stopped, you know, and I've been with him. And cop would come up there and he said, you're Jerry Lawler. And he said, yeah. Oh, man, you know. And he'd write him a ticket for the least that he could do. He'd cut it way down from 105. He'd cut it down to like 65. And that's when the speed limit was like 55. You know, the big oil scare, 55 miles an hour, making those trips. Oh, took you forever to do it. And the guy would get back in his car and Lawler says, well, I'm going to file this away. He'd open up his glove compartment and there was nothing but that paper stuffed in there. They were all tickets. They were tickets from Tennessee and Kentucky, Indiana, Alabama, Mississippi. He said, this is where I file these away. And then he was too full and he said, nah, I'm going to do a different filing. He just tore it up, threw it away. I said, do you ever pay him? He said, nah. Now you can't do that. You'll have to, when you went to get your license, and it may have been in effect then, but when you go and get your license and you have a ticket, you haven't paid, you have to pay it before you get your license back. Another one not to ride with, and he's passed on now, Buddy Landale. There's another crazy bastard. He would drive at 100 miles an hour. He had a Mercedes-Benz one time. He drove it so hard, he lost his drive gear, and he drove it in second as far as hard as he could. Of course, he ended up ruining the car. Another guy was Dick Murdoch. Oh, he was talking and he was drinking. And I made myself a mental note. Listen, the next time you need a ride, why don't you eliminate Dirty Dick from your choices? Because he's going to get you killed. And it's a wonder, after I think back of all these miles we used to do. See, old back in the day, we just saw a plane fly. You never got on one unless you went to Japan or somewhere. You had to drive everywhere. And it was like 2,000, 2,500, sometimes 3,000 miles a week. Now, you wouldn't necessarily put it on your car, but if you added it all up, if you got rides with other guys or they rode with you, you were traveling about 3,000 miles a week. So I've wondered in many times why wrestlers didn't have more deaths on the highway than they did. Mm-hmm. Because especially with drinking and driving, and I never tried to do that. And now I'm totally against even drinking and getting behind the wheel when you're drinking at all. Because mm-hmm. I think those people, they need to be put in jail and kept there because they kill people that are not drinking, have nothing to do with it. Like Tammy Sitch, you know, she killed that guy in Florida, 75 years old, and he was just sitting at a red light, and here she come, bam, and hit him. And they still haven't sentenced her yet. I think she'll get 10 years, I think.
I think the maximum she can get is 25. We'll refer to that.
I don't think they'll give her 25, but I think they'll give her 10.
Yeah.
But you need to give her really 15 and keep her in there for 10.
We'll talk about that when she's sentenced. We will move on for now, though. Jeff Davison, does Dutch have any stories of Jackie Fargo's brother, Roughhouse, a.k.a. Nuthouse Fargo? The angle was that Roughhouse was in an insane asylum and only Jackie could get him released for brief periods of time, usually to help Jackie settle a score with the wrestling opponents. Thanks, love the podcasts.
Yeah. Roughhouse was, he was crazy anyway, even in, not real life, but, you know, but they painted this picture that Jackie Fargo, don't make him get his brother to come in. And he said he was in a mental house or prison or something, but he could get him out. Certain weekends and certain weeks, so he could see his family. And he did just a crazy man gimmick. And every time that, you know, he needed a partner, sometimes here come Rough House. And he'd go in there and he'd be in overalls or whatever he was in. He just acted nuts. And the people bought it. And Jackie was really over. And that was when Jackie and Jerry Lawler, they were a hot duo. So Lawler would get him a tag team partner, and they'd bring Fargo in. And it was entertaining, I'll say that. They did a lot of entertaining stuff, not wrestling stuff, but just entertaining out of the ordinary stuff.
So who was this guy in real life then?
Oh, he's his real brother.
Oh, really? His real brother?
He's his real brother. He was.
And you sort of said beforehand that he wasn't, he sort of was crazy in real life then. So what was he to hang around with?
No, he was okay.
Yeah.
He was, well, let me back this up. I don't know if it was his real brother or not, but hell, it's one or the other. He is or he's not. But the guy was a referee in the Mid-Atlantic territory. So they would bring him in when they wanted him to do something, and he would come in and he'd draw a big house and then he'd leave.
His real name, I'm going to pronounce it very carefully, Jack Faggart. He was Sonny Roughhouse Fargo, but also he was a referee, as well, as you rightly say. Best known for his appearances as NWA Mid-Atlantic in the 60s
okay.
and 70s.
Look Jackie Fargo's real name.
Okay, one sec. And his real name is Henry Faggart.
So they were brothers.
Yeah?
They were brothers.
Yeah, I thought they were plastic brothers as well, you know. I thought they just found someone who looked remotely like him. And, you
know. Well, the Fargo name was a big name in wrestling. Don Fargo and Jackie, they drew big-time money up in the eastern part of the country before they came to Tennessee. And Don Fargo used to tell me stories. He said they used to go as a motorcycle gang. They called some name. So they went to Cleveland one night, and one of the Hell's Angels or one of those guys came up to him and said, hey, yeah, they're having a party. And would they come? And they said, yeah, we'll come. So after the matches, they told them where to come, and they met them, and they went out in the country into this lake area, like a picnic area. And that's where they were going to have a little get together and drinking and all this. Well, they didn't bring them out there to party with them. They brought them out there to kill them. So one of the guys ended up getting the crap beat out of him. And Don ran. He saw what was happening. And they tried to shoot him and they missed. And they beat the hell out of the other guy. So that was the end of the team then. And they stopped teaming up. They started teaming up as bikers because the bikers didn't like it. Well, he told me that story one time, and I don't know the real the particulars about it, but he said you couldn't pay him to even put on one of those biker vests. Couldn't do it. They invited Jimmy Valiant too, and he said he'd already heard the story. He went, hell no, I'm not going out there. I'm not even messing with him.
I'd actually watched last night Rolling Stones documentary. I can't remember if it's the Scorsese one. I don't know if he did one, but I think he may have done. And it covers the Altamont Speedway murder. And, you know, in 69.
What was the name of that one?
Altamont Speedway. What, you mean the documentary, the Rolling Stones one?
Yeah, not Altamont.
No, it wasn't called Altamont.
It's where they shot the guy.
Yeah. It's called Meredith.
They were pulling security. They were pulling security for him, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
The guy, he was a black geezer with like a bright green suit on. He was apparently just like absolutely rolling on some sort of drugs, whatever it was, I don't know, he was going crazy. He pulled the gun and then someone else grabbed him and stabbed him several times.
That's what happened.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll move on. Abraham.
But they did it. They did it right in front of the Rolling Stones.
Did it right in front of the Rolling Stones. And yep. It was on film as well.
Amazingly. 20 feet away.
Yeah. The guy who stabbed him was acquitted for self-defense.
In California, right?
Is it? Altamont Speedway?
I think so.
Probably is.
I think it was Altamont. That's what I'm thinking.
Altamont Speedway. It'll bug me now.
Counterculture. It was a big deal.
Tracy, California. Right. Okay. I'm going to move on now.
Okay.
Abraham Achenbach. Keep up the great work, guys. Never miss a show. Had a question for Dutch regarding non-wrestling talent taking bumps. I've seen where Goldilocks says she was fired for not being willing to take a black hole slam, and where Mark Madden was an unwilling participant to being roughed up by Tank Abbott. Where is the line when non-wrestlers are asked to take bumps, and are they contractually obligated to do it?
Well, first of all, things have changed since the early days of wrestling, but I think you're talking about days in the 2000s about Mark Madden.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you don't ask people to take a bump if they don't know how. Because if they get hurt, they're going to sue. They're going to sue the company and the person that told them to take it. So Goldilocks, I don't really begrudge her the right to say I'm not doing it, because she was probably afraid she's going to get hurt too. And Mark Madden, they wanted him to do what with Tank Abbott?
I don't know. Probably just
hell. I wouldn't take a bump for Tank Abbott now. Hell, he was. People that don't know what they're doing, they can get hurt badly. And I don't blame Mark or Goldilocks for not doing it.
Is that true that Goldilocks was fired for refusing to take a black hole slam?
She had some more issues that just built up. And I don't know where that came from. I think Vince Russo was there. I think it was his idea. And she didn't want to do it. And they just got rid of her. I had nothing to do with it.
Who would have made that call
again,
to a fire?
Again, I mind my own business. Hmm. So, but I would never ask her to do that.
Yeah, well, that strikes me as weird then. So she probably very rightly refuses to do that because she doesn't know how to take a slam like that and
absolutely
not get hurt. So then who makes the call to fire her then?
I don't know. I don't know if she got fired or they just told her to stay home. It's the same thing, but with the wording of it, I fired her because I'm pretty sure it had to come from Vince Russo.
We will move on. John Devers, I hope I've pronounced your name correctly there. Dutch, first, thanks for your podcast. My question was about the war for the Memphis Territory in 1977. You were in Memphis when Jerry Jarrett broke away from Nick Gulas and started his own promotion. You went with Jarrett. What made you want to make the move, and was George Gulas really the worst wrestler of all time?
Well, first of all, one of the reasons I wanted to make the move, because I kind of hated Nick, basically, because he was a butthole. And I hated George double than what I hated Nick, because he was a complete idiot. And I always had a lot of respect for Jerry Jarrett. And I remember when I turned my notice in to Nick, and he said, "Hey, boy, you're going over there to that other bunch." And I went, "No, I don't think so." I didn't tell him nothing. But then I went to work for Jarrett and ended up working for him off and on for the next 10 years. See, Nick, I came back and worked for him in 1978, and it was on its ass. You know, Nashville was a pretty good sized town. They had a VHF station, not a UHF, a VHF station, channel 6 or channel 4 or something, that wrestling was on. So we had the coverage, and we only got it up when Randy Savage came in, because we were dying there. I couldn't even pay my bills off that. And me and Savage got together and said, "Hey, let's do this deal between us." And we revised the territory. It came up to where now we were making a little bit of money, not a lot, but it was a lot better than what they were doing before. And then we went through that year and had some really good houses in Nashville and Birmingham and Chattanooga. And then Savage left to start his own company up in Nova Scotia. Don't ask me why Nova Scotia, but they went up there to start a company there. And that's before he came to to Kentucky, mm-hmm. to start his other company. But that's why I went with Jarrett, because I think the money would be there, because Memphis was a good town. Make your money out of Memphis anyway. And Lawler went, because Lawler was, he was over in Memphis. So I knew their business would be fairly good. That's why I went.
You know, I was actually looking up George Gulas' and footage.
Wait a minute. Is he the worst wrestler in the world? Double that. Mm-hmm. He was doubly worst.
I mean, aside from the fact that he looked like shit,
he didn't look that good.
No, he sounded like shit,
and he sounded like shit. He was the shits, really. He was a moron, basically.
Okay, I'm going to pick up on that in a second, but I want to just quickly tell you is that, do you know on YouTube that you can find out there is some sort of like Legends reunion wrestling show where in about 2000. That George Gulas came out of retirement to participate in.
Where was it?
I don't know. I could try and find the video, but shall I find the video and then give you the information on it?
Yeah.
Oh, one sec. Yeah. Okay, so we're back. We can try and watch about a minute of it. Let's see. But I think he's in the Golden Trunks. There we go. Look at those punches. So he's in the Golden Trunks. Jeff Daniels and Gypsy Joe versus Dan Tate and George Gulas and someone else. Look at these punches.
Gypsy Joe. God, he is horrible. Look. Oh, my God.
So apparently his chops...
Let me tell you a George Gulas story. He got caught one night for solicitation by this one cop. And in Nashville, they took him to jail and they got him out. The next night, the same cop caught him again. It was a female cop. And he went after her again. Now, is that stupid?
You said, well, yeah, you've given that example. You said he was a moron, he was an idiot. But just in general, having to hang around with him, like, why do you say that?
He's just an idiot. He acted like an idiot. I didn't spend any more time around him than I had to, because he's a goof. Complete moron.
We will move on. Kerry Lawson. Why does Jack Swagger have issues with John Cena? Was it because Cena was pulling rank and rebooking matches to make himself look strong, or was it something more?
I don't know where this question came from. I don't think there's any heat between Cena and Swagger, really.
No?
Not that I ever heard of. We had a couple of matches with him, and they worked okay. And I never heard Jack say anything out of the way about Cena, and I never heard Cena say anything to me about Jack. So I don't know where that question comes from.
I think I've heard Jack say something on other interviews, not with us, but it's not my place to repeat those things. Maybe we'll have Jack back on sometime and he can explain. But
what do you say?
I think it's basically that he was, that Cena was pulling rank and holding him down, something like that. But I don't want to say that, I don't want to be accused of misquoting. Who knows?
That does happen.
Yeah.
Because they may have wanted to do an angle with Jack and Cena didn't want to do it.
We'll move on. Randy Jones. Hello, James. Ask Dutch if he has any memories of Baron Von Raschke and what does he think of his work rate? Thanks.
I do know the good Baron, good guy. And he was ahead of me. And his work rate was slow and slower. And he depended on the claw. And all I know is his work rate was okay. I mean, he did his job. I mean, he wasn't necessarily going to have them screaming and falling out of their chairs, but he'd put that monocle in there, and he did a great German. So that's all I'm going to say about him.
No,
I don't know him that well.
Okay, then we'll move on. I'll ask you one or two more, then we'll close it up. Corey Kamiski in Silk, Colorado. Dutch, would you consider going to AEW to mentor young talent? I think with your knowledge and experience as a legend, some of these immature wannabe wrestlers might have a chance at a great career because of you. Thanks for entertaining me as a kid in the 80s and as an adult watching you in WWE. Won't they just all ignore you?
If the kids would ignore me, the talent?
Yeah.
Probably. No, you asked me this question this week on our podcast. You
yes.
asked me almost the same one. Would you go? Let me say one thing right now, folks. I've spent 50 years in wrestling, and my patience has run thin about 20 years ago. And if I asked a guy or told a guy this is what we want from him, and he wants to start doubting it and then wants to start talking wrestling philosophy, I don't have time for that. This is a job. This is the job that I come to get paid to help you do a better job. And you get paid to do that job that we want you to do. But no, all of a sudden you don't want to do it and you don't know nothing about the business or where we're going with it. And see, they think they got to be put over all the time. We saw Sami Zayn is the best example that I know. Every time he was on SmackDown, he was getting the dog shit beat out of him and looking at the lights for 3 seconds. That's what he did. But yes, they told a story with him. And all of a sudden, all those losses didn't mean nothing because they liked him. He got over with the fans. You know, we all know somebody like Sammy that busts their ass, but all of a sudden it don't quite hold true. But it didn't hurt him. It actually helped him. So if I went to WWE and I was talking to a guy and they're looking at me, and I tell you how they look at me now, like I'm some relic from the dinosaur age, which they can do that if they want to. But if you're not going to take advantage of the advice or knowledge I can give you, then I don't have time for it. So that would mean I wouldn't be able to do a good job as an agent, nor would I even want to, because 50 years of wrestling has been enough for me.
I've I've just ruined something. Oh, yeah, you're back. For some reason, my camera had zoomed in on your face during that, so it was a really dramatic retelling at the same time.
Well, it did the same to you.
Yeah, people can't see that. Anyway, I've got two webcams. Right, I'm going to ask you one more. Or do you okay. just want to close up?
No, ask me one more.
Right, Cody Charles. Jeff Hardy is one of the most over superstars of the 2000s, obviously has his issues, but where would you rank Jeff Hardy's popularity among his time as WWE champ specifically, for instance? And on the other side, did they make a mistake not pushing Matt Hardy more, even specifically during or after his feud versus Edge? You weren't here for either of those things, so we might have to make it a tiny bit more generic here. Jeff Hardy.
Let me go Matt Hardy first.
Let's go for Matt Hardy. Let's stick with just Matt Hardy. Do you think, I don't know, they could have got behind him more in WWE or TNA from what you saw?
Well, they could have if they wanted to, but guess what? Matt is just an extension of Jeff. Jeff was the team. He was the draw. He was the worker. And Matt was just basically not a tag along, but he was just an appendage that didn't really help the drawing power of the Hardy Boys. Could they have gotten behind Matt a little more? Like I said, yeah, they could have, but they didn't. And there's a reason for that, because they didn't have faith in his drawing ability, nor do I. Now, Jeff's a different story. Jeff comes out there and he's an enigma, and he's, every time I see Jeff, I say, please, somebody give him a sandwich, please, because he's skinny as hell. But he did those moves, and the people liked that, and they felt a connection to him that they didn't feel with Matt. What's the next question?
No, we're going to stick with that then. So what's Matt missing then that Jeff has?
Connection. He don't have the moves that Jeff does. He doesn't have the charisma. He doesn't have the connectivity, I guess, with the fans. Neither one of them could talk worth a crap, but you could kind of get by that with Matt. See, Matt could sit there and look off into space and say something. Well, that's him. But Jeff couldn't do that. And it's hard to believe that they're two brothers, but they made them a tag team, I guess. You know, they started when they were about 15. Mm-hmm. And they started, everybody was beating them. You know, if they really knew their ages, if somebody wanted to bring that out, they're 15 years old and they're doing this and they're driving all this way, that would have been they could have been looked at very unfavorably because of doing that to 15-year-old kids. But Matt was the tag along, Jeff was the draw. And that's why Jeff has never, Matt's never really done anything on his own. I mean, the Hardy did well as a team, but Matt on his own never did that much.
You fan of Rebby?
Now, Matt, let me tell you, if you hear this, I love you, brother. I'm just telling you like I see it.
Are you a fan of Rebby Hardy?
Oh, yeah, I had a big beef with her. I said something on Twitter one day, and it's X now. Oh, she got all tore up and this, that, and the other. But I will say one thing about Matt. Matt stays out of her stuff. And she was saying, and she'd come back at me, and I said, oh, I made her mad. I said, think of the baby. Oh, goddamn, you son of a bitch. I went, I don't think it was that bad. I mean, it's Matt Hardy's wife, so I'm going to show her respect. I don't care what she says, because I don't want Matt coming to me and say, why did you say that to my wife? Well, I wouldn't want anybody to say that to my wife. I'm one of the guys, so I don't say anything. I'm going to go back to my new line of defense. I stay in my lane. That's it. Me and Dave Capello.
You and who? Dave who?
Huh?
You and who?
Dave Capello. Who's me and Dave? Me and Dave Capello.
Who's Dave Capello? Oh, you mean Dave Chappelle?
Not Chappelle. I thought his name was Capello. Chappelle. Chappelle.
Yeah, Chappelle.
Okay, that's what I said.
I was thinking you were what, Michael David Capetta or something like that. I don't know. I was trying to. Anyway, forget it. Right. We're gonna. Before
I haven't heard. I haven't heard about that guy in years.
He's on Twitter somewhere, I think. I think he's relatively active. He's probably got a podcast like everyone else has.
Well, everybody else. You know how many you know how many people in the world? 8 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
And 7,500,000,000 have podcasts.
I know. Still ours is pretty successful.
Everybody has a podcast. So, but I don't know. We done? Are we done?
I think we better be done, yeah.
We got one more. Oh, we got one more.
No, that's the last one. I mean, I've got loads more. I mean, I've written, hang on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more left. But they can all
okay, be... Did the people get, and what question do I want? Oh, I want them to write in and say the top 3 wrestling podcasts they listen to.
Okay. Should we also ask for the worst podcasts? Or will that just be inviting most of us to say us?
Ask about. Well, we'll agree with them. give us the top 3 and then give us the bottom 3.
I would be very interested to know that. So, okay, by the time this comes out, it'll already be out. The YouTube community board on Storytime with Dutch Mantel YouTube channel. I will have posted the question, what is your favorite and least favorite wrestling podcasts and why? But for now, I'm going to say thank you very much for watching. We'll see you on Friday, and Dutch, we the people.
We the people. See you then.